Welcome to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers' Fest. The Vancouver Writers' Fest connects people to exceptional books, ideas, and dialogue through year-round programming that ignites a passion for words and the world around us. I'm Leslie Hertig, Artistic Director, and I'm very happy to share this conversation featuring Scotiabank Giller Prize winner Omar Elakhed in conversation with the Globe and Mail's Mark Medley. This event was recorded live on October 22nd, 2021, as part of the Vancouver Writers' Festival. The Vancouver Writers' Fest carries out its work, including this event you are about to listen to, on the unceded and ancestral territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. This event features acclaimed author and journalist Omar Elakhed speaking with Mark Medley about his new book, What Strange Paradise, published by Penguin Random House.
Hello.
How you doing?
This is the first time I have worn a blazer in 2 years. This is really, really weird.
I mean, it looks like it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I never get a haircut. This is going to take me a while. I did these, you know, all the time in the before days. And over the last 18 months, you know, I've been living, as I think many of us have been, on screens. And I've done, you know, plenty of virtual events. And I almost feel like I should be talking to you. Like, I want to put a laptop here, almost. It's going to take a while. So please bear with me. As I said, there's going to be time for questions from the audience at the end. There's going to be a microphone right at the front. And so I'll try not to take up our entire hour. I'm very excited to be here. I guess I should say, Omar and I go back a couple of decades. We first met in university in a creative writing workshop taught by Carolyn Smart, the recently retired head of, creative writing at Queen's. And then we were on the editorial board of a literary magazine. At the same time, you were writing for the Queen's Journal and went into journalism. You know, you went to the Globe. You became a star globetrotting reporter. I went to the Post. You're being modest. And I guess my first question is, you know, when you went into journalism and you went to the Globe, I guess I kind of figured fiction was done for you, that you were, you know, you'd approached a time in your life where there is two paths you could take, and you chose journalism. But from what I understand, you were writing novels the entire time, weren't you?
Yeah. First of all, thank you for doing this. And thank you all for coming out. This is far more emotional than I thought it would be. This is the first time in 2 years. Mark and I went to school together. The central difference, I think, is that he still looks exactly the same way he did in college.
Yeah.
Whereas the rest of us swamp creatures are aging in dog years.
There's a painting in my attic that is aging.
Matt, you were bragging last night about getting carded.
Yes.
And being mistaken for...
I turned 40 this year.
I'm going to give you so much grief over the next hour is what I'm trying to say.
Please do.
I ended up going to the Globe. My degree's in computer science. I can't program my way out of a paper bag because I spent all of my time at the student newspaper instead of actually going to class. And it worked out very fortunately because I had enough of a portfolio that I was able to apply to the Globe. Usually the Globe, their summer interns, at least when I was doing this, come from the major J schools, right? And Queen's didn't have a J school, and so I just showed up. And they'd already hired all of their interns for the summer, but the investment reporter had decided to split parental leave with his wife. And so anyway, they were out an investment reporter just as I showed up for the interview. And they were stuck between a rock and a hard place. They needed a body. So they were like, fine, show up. And I show up the first day. I walk in, I had $7 in change in my checking account. And Marty Say, who was the investments editor at the time, says, you, come here, we have the story. John Smith at Credit Suisse is saying that you should buy high on beta, write it up. And very little of that sentence sounded like it was in English. I had no conception of what the hell was going on, so I faked it through that whole summer. I was writing the investment advice column. If you made any investments in the summer of 2005 based on anything the Globe told you to do, I apologize. It was not It was not great, but one of the things I remember...
You were writing fiction even then.
I was writing fiction, exactly. It was a bad move on everybody's part, and I'm amazed they kept me on. But the first day when I showed up, there's this guy, he was a legend. He passed away a couple of years ago. His name is Greg O'Neill. Mm-hmm. Greg O'Neill was the dean of the editing, the back desk corps. And he was one of those people, to give you a sense of this mythical figure that he was. Years later, I was doing an assignment in New Orleans, and I happened to mention this to him. And he said, oh, New Orleans, hold on, I'll give you the document. I was like, and he sends me this Word document that's 20 pages of the secret speakeasies of New Orleans, because apparently he, and so it's full of stuff like, you know, go behind the abandoned church, you'll meet Big Jim, don't look Big Jim in the eye, he'll take you to the basement where they make the fish whiskey, don't drink the fish whiskey, you know. Like, it was 20 pages of that. It's still one of the most amazing documents I've ever read. Anyway, so Greg O'Neill sits me down, and he gives me the speech he gives to every intern on their first day. He says, listen, what you need to know about this place is that here all the reporters are gods, and all the editors are atheists. And it was his way of explaining to me what was about to happen to my copy. You know, if you put in one adjective, one description, they were going to cut that thing to shreds. And that was my writing education, because that's... At the time, my first love has always been fiction, and so over the next 10 years that I spent at the Globe, I wrote 3 novels before American War, got to the end of each one before realizing it was horrible, but finished them all, and then also wrote American War. And it was also going to sit on the hard drive. I wasn't going to show it to anybody, and then I had a bad day at work. Mm. I had one of those days where I felt like I was just rewriting press releases. And I remember I got off the phone with Sink, the managing editor at the time, and I thought, to hell with this, and I emailed a literary editor who an agent who I'd met a few years earlier, and the email was just like, you know, I know it's every agent's worst nightmare when a journalist says, I have a novel for you, but I have a novel for you. And she was kind enough to read it. She decided to send it to Knopf in New York, and 3 months later we sold it, and I basically won the lottery, and that's when I quit.
Yeah, to Sunny Mehta, of all editors, publishers.
Yeah.
It was a fairy tale.
It was, and it'll never be like that again. I mean, I got to experience that. It's. I think it'll remain the highlight of the career.
I'm curious. I mean, for those of us who have read your first 2 novels, I can't but help. But you know, to me, they seem very much informed by your time in journalism. I'm curious how writing for the Globe and, you know, learning your craft as a journalist changed your approach to fiction.
I mean, it gave me the education I didn't get at Queens, basically, right? You know, I got to go places that otherwise I wouldn't have in any conceivable context. I got to cover the war in Afghanistan. I was down most of 2008, was back and forth to Guantanamo Bay to cover the pretrial hearings for Omar Khadr. I was in Egypt after the Arab Spring. I was in Ferguson the night they decided not to indict the guy who killed Mike Brown. It was sort of first draft of history, mm-hmm. A lot of the books are basically the residual experiences from that. The stuff that I wasn't good enough to figure out in a nonfiction setting, I sort of set. You know, the novels they have very little of a prescriptive element to them. There's no if you do X, Y, Z, things will work out. That doesn't appear here because it's mostly just questions left over from my time there. With American War, I had written a good chunk of the story, but I didn't figure out where it was going to start. And then I was on assignment in southern Louisiana, that same thing that Greg O'Neill gave me the document for, and I look around, and it's... The land in southern Louisiana is disappearing at the rate of about a football field every hour. It's one of the worst climate change disasters in North America. And as soon as I saw it, I knew this is the place, this is where I had to go. So I don't think these books get written at all, certainly not in the same way, if it wasn't for those 10 years at the Globe.
Do you miss reporting?
When it was good.
Yeah.
Yeah. When it was bad, you know that whole like comfort the afflicted, afflict the comfortable?
Yeah.
When it was bad, it was the opposite of that.
Yeah.
Right? When it was bad, the only person who was pleased by the article you put out was the PR person for Apple or something like that. And you think, you know, what I wanted to do more than anything was cover stories that had I not written them, they wouldn't have been written.
Yeah.
And for a good chunk of my time at the Globe, I was doing the exact opposite.
Yeah.
I was going to the iPod release, you know, and it's great because the PR person's going to take you out to a really nice restaurant that you otherwise can't afford or whatever. And And it was just, you were getting this from 600 other reporters. And after a while, it got to be that I was doing a disservice to everybody involved because I was this tech reporter who didn't give a damn about a lot of the stuff I was covering. There's other people who would kill for this job at the Globe and Mail. It's not like I'm doing a throwaway job, you know? The newspaper is not particularly happy. And so as soon as I sold American War, I figured if under these circumstances you're not willing to jump off the cliff and hope there's water at the bottom, you're never going to do it in your life. And so that was the moment.
So let's talk about What Strange Paradise, published by McClellan and Stewart Canada. You can buy it in the lobby.
Thank you. Thank you.
The first image in this book is of a boy seemingly dead lying on a beach. And I don't think one can encounter that image without thinking of the photo of Alan Kurdi. And so I'm curious if that photo was in your mind when you started this book, and if not, you know, what was the genesis of this novel? Where did it come from?
So the closest thing I have to a genesis moment was in 2012. It was another Globe assignment, actually. I was in Egypt. I was covering the aftermath of the Arab Spring, and I was born in Egypt. I left when I was five, and I grew up in the Middle East. And one of my friends from high school who had moved back to Egypt, we were driving around town one night, and he was complaining about rent. You know, rent's too high. And at one point I asked him, well, sort of, okay, what's the price for an apartment in your building? And he said, well, do you mean the local's price or do you mean the Syrian's price? I was like, what the hell's the Syrian's price? What are you talking about? And he was like, well, we've had this influx of people come in, and they don't have a choice. You can charge them three times as much. I mean, what are they going to do, go somewhere else? And, you know, everybody has their moment. And for me, that was the moment when I started thinking about this, just the necessity of that layer of cruelty and how easy and reflexive it was to do it. This wasn't just apartments. This was when you went down to the fruit and vegetable vendor down the street, same thing. They could tell right away, oh, you're from this group, you know. That was when I first started thinking in the broadest sense about this particular book. I then started writing it, and one of the things that was happening was there were these pinprick moments, and that photo, of course, was one of them. Mm-hmm. It was a sort of devastating photo. One of the things about it that sticks with me is that because we live in the context of social media, it comes packaged with outrage, right? You don't just see the photo. You see it tweeted by somebody with a comment of how awful this is. And I was amazed at how, you know, you would see these images and these stories of these boats that would go down, and there was immense outrage in this part of the planet for about 24 hours. And then we would all move on to the next thing. And it was almost like a self-defense mechanism, particularly during the Trump years, right? I can't tell you what the scandal of the day was 2 years ago today. Yeah. I genuinely can't. And it's almost as a self-defense mechanism, you have to move on, and I wanted to do the opposite of move on. I wanted to dwell. And so there were these pinprick moments. Obviously, that photo is one of them. The other one is, in the States, the reference point is there was a photo of a man and his daughter who were trying to cross the Rio.
I remember that, yeah.
Right, and that photo, again, just immense deserved outrage for about 24 hours. Yeah. And then it was old news. And so that's when the book started to hone in on the idea of, no, we're going to stay here. Mm-hmm. And we're going to stay here even if I have to move into the world of fantasy to do it. Mm-hmm. I should say I don't know if I have the right to do any of this. For the entirety, because of the stories I pursue, almost the entirety of the Globe and Mail career that I consider worthwhile outside of the tech reporter business stuff, and also my career as a fiction writer, I've basically been a tourist in somebody else's misery. And I don't know if I have the right to do that, and there's no but at the end of that sentence. Mm-hmm. That's still something that, and I don't know if I'm able to do this much longer, because the way that you justify it to yourself is you say, well, on the other side of this, it might have an impact. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody might read this book, change their perception, it might, but then the world is constantly telling you that that's not true. Mm-hmm. And so it's a difficult place to go to, but that was sort of the thinking when I was first putting it together.
American War is, for those of you in the audience who haven't read it, you know, an epic novel. It is one in which Omar envisions an entire world, an entire history, populates it with a large cast of characters. and it takes place over the course of several decades. To me, one of the things that struck me was this very much feels like the inverse. This is a very confined, constrained, intimate novel. I mean, it takes place mostly on an island and on a boat, which is, you know, two of the most confined settings you can get. I'm curious if that is something consciously you set out to do, especially because it's a small, these are small settings, but you're tackling the migrant crisis, which is such a big issue. And you know, I'm just curious about that decision to willingly, you know, paint on such a small canvas, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, it was a scary thing, right? I remember I was on a panel with David Cherryandy once, who was talking about Brother, and how every time he edited Brother, it got a little bit shorter. Yeah. And if he kept going, it would just stop being a book, it would just sort of disappear eventually. And it was a similar experience with this. It kept getting, at one point I deleted something close to 30,000 words in the form of monologues from the people on the boats that were sort of interspersed between the chapters, which I missed, but they weren't working. It was a scary thing for a number of reasons. One is that on a surface level, I think in terms of intent, both books are very similar, but on a surface level, it's a very different book, right? And so it's not like American War was out there selling like Harry Potter numbers or something, but it did well. It did well by my standards. And to then go to your editor and say, hey, just as the career is picking up, here's this thing that's completely different, has none of the like world-building elements or... The central difference between the two books for me is that, for better or worse, this isn't a judgment on quality, but I think What Strange Paradise survives a surface reading. You know, the language is not terrible, the story is not terrible. And I think it survives a really deep reading when the Apocrypha references and Paradise Lost and the Odyssey and all the rest of it starts to come out. I don't think it survives anything in the middle. Whereas American War, I think the exact opposite. I think it doesn't survive a surface reading because, hey, this isn't how a second American Civil War would go down. These things are all wrong. And I don't think it survives a deep reading because you start to see the flaws in the places where I've clearly cheated to try and get my point across. I think it survives everything in the middle. So it feels like a very different book just from the writing perspective for that reason. But yeah, I didn't know what the hell this was going to do. And I didn't expect much. And I was scared.
Yeah. You mentioned you've been thinking about this book since 2012, and from you know what we talked about yesterday, you wrote it before the pandemic. But I'm curious if the experience of being in lockdown, you know, your own kind of experiences of confinement, bled into the narrative during the editing process, or in any shape or form.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote the last little bit of it and edited it pretty much substantially during that. That period, and one of the things that happens is that towards the very end of the earliest drafts, so the drafts that I basically sold it on, I don't sell like based on a synopsis or whatever. I write the whole thing and then find out if I've just wasted a few years of my life. My editor Sonny Mehta passed away, and suddenly everything felt very much like the entire process of the, you write it, and that's one thing, and then you publish it, and that's an entirely different thing. It's an entirely different beast. And that just felt so much more like, flavorless and joyless. And then the pandemic happened, and we were in lockdown, I think, 2 or 3 weeks after the funeral. Mm-hmm. It was the last trip I did was to New York for the memorial service. And I found, I don't know what other people's experience of reading and writing during the pandemic was, but I found that the anxiety was starting to seep in, and it made it difficult to write, and made it difficult to read. And I couldn't judge the quality of the changes anymore. You know, is this making it better? Is it making it worse? Mm-hmm. And so I had to outsource that to, you know, my friend Anna, who's my reader on all my projects, my editor Tim, who had worked for Sonny, and I had to basically take their word for it. These changes were making the book better and not just sort of wrecking the thing.
Had that ever happened to you before, where this kind of doubt creeps into your writing and you don't know if you're making the right decisions anymore?
Oh, all the time, just not in this particular form. You know? Like with American War, it was what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
Like you have a day job that you are willingly doing badly now so that you can spend time on this thing. I had no agent or publisher or book deal or any expectation it would see the light of day. In fact, I had 3 novels worth of evidence that it wouldn't see the light of day. So that was the doubt. You're wasting your time. What are you doing? And it got so bad, actually, at one point I deleted the thing. And I went to the recycle bin. I made sure that it was gone, and because I'm a very insecure, petty person. And then I had to go, took a walk down to the Willamette River and just sort of like, the only conversation I could have in my head that allowed me to not give up on it fully was, yeah, okay, you might be bad at this, but you're so much worse at everything else. This is what you were meant to do. So I went back and picked up a previous version. I think I lost like 3 chapters because of that. With this one, the central doubt mechanism was, you're a one-hit wonder. You got lucky with that last book. You know, this isn't gonna. And if I'm lucky enough to have a third one, there will be some new and it's the most inventive part of my mind is the one that's coming up with these. You know, so I think I just wasn't prepared for. I was prepared for a certain set of anxieties, and instead the pandemic came along and I got a different set, and it threw me off a bit.
Yeah. I'm always hesitant to ask a writer about the research they did, but I'm going to ask you regardless. I mean, when you sat down, you knew this was going to be the next novel you were going to write. Did you travel to the Mediterranean? I mean, what did you do to kind of prepare yourself before, you know, putting pen to paper?
So I'd done trips before. Mm-hmm. I conceived of it as back when it was kind of like an amorphous thing.
Yeah.
So in those early days, I'd done those trips. And then as it became more and more of a concrete thing, I had to put borders on what I was researching, you know, and I ended up, there's a lot in here. There's the actual trips. Mm-hmm. There's my childhood. Mm-hmm. So in this novel, there's the central characters are 2 children, and they're from different experiences, and they don't speak the same language, and a lot of time they're sort of making up this ad hoc language of, you know, just how old are you, 5, 6, 7, you know. And a lot of that was from growing up in Qatar. Qatar is little peninsula sticking out of Saudi Arabia, and pound for pound, I think the richest country on earth. And as a result, 90% of Qatar is not Qatari. 90% of the population are people from somewhere else who've come in to cash in on the oil and gas wealth. And so, you know, my dad worked at a hotel, he was an accountant, and I would be at the beachside, you know, the hotel beachside, and you'd see another kid and you want to play, but they're from somewhere else in the world. And so a lot of my experiences growing up, when I think of like the earliest friendships, they were all like that. So there was a lot of that bled in. Mm. And then there was just a lot of research the way that you're currently, he's going to have a book. We have to hold him to, he's got a book that the deadline's been pushed back. He says because of COVID, but I think it's his own.
We're not here to talk about my
fault.
Book. Nobody's interested in what I'm doing.
But anyway.
Good try, though.
I'm sure it'll be a commercial and critical disaster, but yes. I will refuse to work with any publisher that touches it. I'm just letting you know right now.
We share a publisher, so.
Oh, my God, we do share a publisher.
Yeah.
That's so. Right. Damn it. You leave. I was there first. So anyway, the kind of research you would do, your books, you get a ton of them, and so on the migrant journey across the Mediterranean, but also the book that inspired this the most was a book called The Wandering Jews, which came out about 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's about Eastern European Jews who are fleeing horrible persecution and coming to the western edge of the continent, only to find a different but equally intense kind of persecution. And the thing about that book was that you could change the place name slightly, and the details would ring so true to what is currently happening across the Mediterranean, and that influenced this more than anything else, I think.
I call the subject of this book the migrant crisis, and I kind of paused before I did that because I'm not sure how I feel about that label. You know, to me, a wildfire is a crisis, a drought is a crisis. We're talking about humans who are just trying to live. It was labeled as such, you know, a few years ago when it was the story of the year in the media. I'm curious, as a former journalist, how you saw the migrant crisis covered and what your views were on it and what the media did wrong and how it could have been done better, I guess.
I mean, having come up in the world of the media, I'm always sort of reluctant to be like, this is the media's fault entirely because so much of every other aspect of society informs this. I mean, yeah, Lebanon had a migrant crisis. Mm-hmm. One of the richest societies in human history, Western Europe, taking in a relatively tiny number of people who are among the most destitute on earth, they didn't have a crisis. What you had, I think, was I think a little bit about a collision of fantasies, right? So when I was about 4 years old, my dad wanted to get the hell out of Egypt. The political situation was awful, and the economic situation was awful, and he couldn't stay there anymore. And he ended up getting a job offer in Libya. And so we're at the airport, and the way Arab names work is that it's your first name, and then your middle name is your father's name, and next name is... So I'm Omar Muhammad Ahmed. And my father's name was Muhammad Ahmed Al-Aed. And Muhammad Ahmed just happens to be the most common combination of two names that you can have in the world. So anyway, there was somebody on the terrorism watch list who was named Muhammad Ahmed. So we get called into secondary. We're kept there long enough, we miss the flight. My dad's job offer in Libya is rescinded. And a few weeks later, I think, he got a job offer in Qatar, which ends up a few years later becoming the richest place on earth because of what. And so the entirety of my existence, the reason I sound like this, because I went to British and American schools from an early age, everything was determined by a coin flip before I had anything to say. Like, I had no say in any of this. And I was thinking a little bit about that. I was thinking a little bit about just the nature of how much of this is preordained before you have any say in it. And also the idea that I had a fantasy about this part of the world and this part of the world had a fantasy about me. And so this book takes place in the collision of those two fantasies. The one that says everyone coming from this side is barbarians at the gate and we need to do everything we can to stop them, including burn out our own society if we have to. And then the one headed in the other direction that if I can just make it to this part of the world, everything will be okay.
Yeah.
And so this book takes place in the collision of those two fantasies.
That reminds me of something that Quiet Uncle, who is Amir, the boy's guardian, you know, his stepfather in the book, when the family is leaving Syria for Egypt at the start of the book, he keeps repeating himself over and over. What he wants is the chance at life, the chance at life. This is why they're leaving. And that really, that stuck with me. I remember kind of like underlining it in my notes. And I'm curious, I mean, on one hand, it seems like the most simple thing, and yet it's something that many people are unwilling to extend to people who are just asking for that. I mean, why is it that something as seemingly simple as the chance at life still such a big ask on, you know, Western countries, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, I should say that my own political opinions about this are on the fairly radical end of the spectrum. Like, if you ever go to Bay Street and you meet a real proponent of the invisible hand, like the real free market capitalism types that I don't want to go anywhere near. I'm that for the invisible foot. I'm very much a sort of, no, it's the onus is on this country to tell me why I can't be there rather than me telling, you know, so I'm very much on that end of the spectrum. I don't know that what's being asked for isn't radical. Right, because my instinct is that if you just want a place to be, you just want a place to be safe and call home, that shouldn't be. But I think we've created the kind of society where that request is now radical, and I don't think that's the fault of the person making the request. And so I'm very much, I write about systems more than anything else. Individual transgressions make their way into the novel, but I'm very much almost always writing about systems. And if you have a makeup of society that causes the simple desire to have a safe home to be seen as a radical thing, then that's the society you have to fix, not the person.
I think the character in the novel who most embodies systems is the Colonel Kethros, who is, you know, the antagonist of the novel, chasing the two children across the island. You know, this is, as I think I said in my introduction, very much a novel about, you know, rules and laws and how they're imposed, how they're interpreted and how they're, you know, wielded in many cases. And, you know, Kethros at one point says that we are in a position to be fled to and not fled from is because we have systems, rules, proper ways of doing things. So I'm curious as what your ambitions were for that character, and what do you make of his worldview and the systems that really dictate his life, you know?
Yeah, I mean, one of the odd things about my books, man, there's two of them. Yeah.
They're books.
Almost everything I write, even the short stories, and probably something I should be taking up with my therapist more than anything else, is that the villains are the most honest characters in the stories. They lie to everyone else, but they're honest with themselves. And this is the case with Colonel Kethros. The book, for lack of a better term, steals from a lot of places. It steals from the Odyssey and Paradise Lost. And one of the places that it steals the most from is Peter Pan, the original Peter Pan story. I wanted to take a comforting fairy tale that Westerners have been telling their kids for 100 years, and I wanted to invert it and use it to tell a different kind of story. So Colonel Kethros is my Captain Hook,
yeah.
Right? And he is... Back when I was in high school, I had a physics teacher who was obsessed with formulas. I mean, all physicists to a certain extent are obsessed with formulas, but his thing was that you should never memorize these things. You should never have to just sort of, you should be able to derive them from first principles, right? And I think of Colonel Kethros as somebody who has an understanding of masculinity, an understanding of what it means to be a strong man in the world, that is purely the memorization of formulas. Mm-hmm. And he has no idea how to derive these things from basic principles, from kindness, from what it means to be a decent human being. Mm-hmm. And so he's this very sort of chivalrous, and there's one scene where he rescues a drowning girl from the beach and then immediately slaps her father around for not showing enough decorum and dignity in the moment when he thought his daughter was going to die. I think of him as someone who has a very brittle sort of surface layer understanding of what it means to be a man. Mm-hmm. And the second that's broken, which it is by the arrival of this refugee child on his island that he associates with his youth, the second it's broken, the only thing holding it up is violence.
Yeah.
That's all he's got to rely on, because he has no thread connecting these things he believes about a firmness of a handshake and looking people in the eye and all that stuff that we're taught mm-hmm. makes a man. He has no connection between that and anything resembling human decency. Mm-hmm. And so he's one of the most honest characters in the book, and he's really awful, and I think about him all the time.
You say he's the most honest character, but to me, a character that I was, you know, that I gravitated towards as far as honesty goes, not that I admire him at all, is Muhammad, who, you know, I won't reveal his role in the book for spoilers, but he seems to be, to me, the one character who sees the world for what it really is. And in a very... you know, I think blunt, uncaring, but probably accurate way. You know, he is one of the people on the boat, and you know, he very much, I think, scoffs at the idea at what they're doing is going to change their lives. You know, there's that one line he says that, you know, the idea that once they get to Europe, their problems will be solved. You thought a way was enough, but it's not. It never is. And, you know, later he's kind of comparing the migrants to Westerners and saying, you know, you're never going to actually understand that they're the engines and you are the fuel. Can you kind of talk about the development of Muhammad, especially with what you said before, as some of the characters on the boat, I think, were a little bit more fleshed out in earlier drafts? I mean, he was just somebody who, you know, I was just interested where he came from.
Yeah, I mean, so the way the book works is that it opens on the scene of a child who is the sole survivor of a migrant shipwreck on an unnamed Western island. And then from that point, the chapters alternate before and after. The after chapters are everything that happens once this child gets up and what happens on the island. And the before chapters are everything that led up to the shipwreck, so how this journey began. And so Colonel Kethros is my Captain Hook of the after chapters, and Muhammad is my Captain Hook of the before chapters. Mm. And again, he lies to a lot of everyone else on the boat, but he's honest with himself. A lot of I don't steal whole people. I don't generally do that, but I do steal snippets of people, and. A lot of it comes from the people I grew up with in the Middle East, and a lot of Muhammad actually comes from family members I know. Mm-hmm. I remember, yeah, that's a distressing thing. You don't have to meet them. They're in Egypt. You probably will not cross paths with them.
Hopefully they're not watching the live stream.
Yeah, you know what? If you are, brace yourself, I guess. So I remember that 2012 trip, I was having a conversation with... a distant cousin of mine who I hadn't seen in forever, and he had gone on to work in the military. He'd achieved a fairly high rank. In Egypt, the military isn't like an outward-facing entity. It's they run the cotton mills, and they're very much within the fabric of domestic life. And we were talking. He did that thing which so many of my relatives, so many people I know in the Arab world do, which is try to convince me that Egyptians aren't ready for democracy. Mm-hmm. That this is, and we have this conversation. It's infuriating because I know it's rooted in self-interest. What he's really trying to say is that, like, the other thing that's not democracy is the place where I'm thriving.
Yeah.
So that's why Egyptians aren't ready for this other thing, you know. And that thread of self-interest and how it crystallizes people's thoughts, how it makes everything. It makes it real clear what road you need to walk on. I think Muhammad has a little bit of that in him. Plus, he knows what's coming. Mm-hmm. You know, most of these folks are one end of the fantasy, but this guy's familiar with the other. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a line where somebody calls him a black market hustler, and he says, you know, you think the black market's bad, wait till you see the white market, sort of thing. And so he's sort of, he has an awareness that functions oddly well with his self-interest.
So I've been kind of like circling around the two main characters, Amir and Vanna, who tell the story, or whose perspectives you write from. I'm curious as to, you know, not to get too personal, but this is, I think, the first novel you've written since you became a father. And you know, do you think you would have approached these characters in the same way a decade ago, 8 years ago, and you know, how did fatherhood kind of infuse itself into this narrative, if at all?
Yeah, I always think of these things, even the ones, even the unpublishable novels, even the really bad ones that came before American War, I think of each one as a sort of eulogy for the person you were when you wrote it, and it's an interesting relationship to have with yourself after. You know, at this point, 20 years have passed since I started these endeavors. It's an interesting relationship to be able to assess yourself via the medium of this thing that is now unchanging. You know, Jorge Luis Borges used to talk about how all literature is tricks, and no matter how clever your tricks are, they will eventually get discovered. And my tricks are not particularly clever. They're usually based on some form of inversion. And so not only do I don't think, if I sat down to write this book right now, it would be a different book.
Yeah.
And if I sat down and wrote it instead of American War back in 2014, it would be an entirely different book. It is very much in that space where I was just coming to terms with being a dad. I'm an only child. I have zero experience with young children, you know, outside of the friends I made when I was at that particular age, sort of thing. And I'm a super slow learner, which is why fiction, particularly novel writing, is a good fit for me, because you can just be wrong for a really long time and then be a little less wrong over time. That doesn't work so well with parenting. You know, you take a year to learn how to deal with a one-year-old.
Yeah.
Now they're 2.5. Yeah. Nothing you've learned is relevant anymore, you know.
No, you're being tossed in the deep end from day one.
And you can't explain, like, you know, kid, you're learning to be one-year-old. You know, sure, I know already what it's like to be that age, but I don't know how to parent that age. You know, like, it was a mess. And my wife is very, very good at it, It's a weird thing to say because American War is so violent, but I don't like violence in my media, and so I move away from that as much as possible. It's a very hypocritical thing to say given what kind of book American War is. But the only thing that supersedes that when it comes to planning and writing these things is the little parcel of reality that I've decided I'm going to anchor the story to. And so in the case of American War, for example, there's a section, by far the most violent section in that book is based on the massacre at Srebrenica, which is a refugee camp. 40 years ago was the site of a huge massacre. And so once I made that connection, for better or worse, I'm not saying it was a good idea, but once I made that connection, I had to stay true to what actually happened. Mm-hmm. And so that's the only thing that supersedes that desire to sort of, that magnetic repel, being repelled from violence. And I think that force grows stronger as I get older and as I spend more time with my children who are, they're just little parcels of joy and they're so happy to see you whether you've had a good writing day or not, and they don't care about any of this in the slightest, and it's very refreshing. So no, I don't think that I could have written it before that particular moment. I don't think I can write it after.
Just a few more questions, and because I want to leave time for the audience to weigh in. I wanted to kind of get back to what happened, or what is happening in the Mediterranean, because there's kind of this, I think, sense that it was a priority in the media a number of years ago, and then, as often happens in the news cycle, you know, the world's gaze drifts elsewhere. But, you know, ships are still coming, boats are still coming. I read that migrant deaths in the Mediterranean have doubled in the first half of 2021 compared to last year. Now, that might be partly because of the pandemic, but it is still happening. I'm curious, I mean, you have obviously, I imagine you've kind of kept up with what's happening in that part of the world. What is the current state? What is it like on the ground there right now? And you know, what do you hope this, if anything, helps achieve as far as making kind of what's happening better?
I mean, I think the rhetoric is still the same. You know, the Arab leaders are still talking about, you know, our Syrian brothers and sisters. And none of it translates to anything on the ground. In fact, the exact opposite is true. We're on the verge, I think, and I hope to be proven wrong, we're on the verge of this crisis on an exponentially larger scale over the next few decades.
You wrote about it for me a few months ago. You're talking about climate migration, right?
Yeah, and you know, when I talk about that, people think like, oh, the island's going to disappear tomorrow, and that's what I'm talking about. You know, when you had a few thousand people on boats fleeing one of the bloodiest civil wars in modern history, the place to which they were fleeing, which again is one of the richest societies in human history, Western Europe, threw an absolute fit and designed a series of barriers so cruel that they became almost, you know, I think of literature as fiction intruding on reality. This was reality intruding on the fictional. It was so cruel. When that is several orders of magnitude greater, what happens then? If this is the reaction that's happening right now, And that's what terrifies me. And it terrifies me sort of vicariously because, you know, I come from a long line of malfunctioning hearts. The men in my family don't live very long, but I have two young children who will have to exist in this world that I think will overlap with this kind of crisis, and we have no capacity to do anything about it that's rooted in anything other than building walls. And so, you know, is this going to fix anything? Probably not, but in so much as literature is the opposite of a wall, I hope it does some of that work. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it will.
So how do we prepare for that? And I don't mean how do we prepare ourselves, but how do we prepare to help, if there's anything we can do?
So again, I'm just a guy who makes stuff up for a living, so please take all of this with an entire bag of salt, but the first thing is because we've created a world of systems, and systems have helped us out quite a bit, and then they result in a lot of great things happening, and we need to come up with systems for enshrining designations, and not from a place of charity, assigning some kind of basic rights framework. Right now there is an immense resistance to the idea. I don't particularly like the term climate refugee. I think it does a little bit of sort of, you know, it makes it sound like an abstraction. This is an abstraction. This is a direct result of how one part of the world has chosen to live over the last 100 years. The default approach to people who are forced from their home under these circumstances or under any violent circumstances is that we need to do something, and it needs to come from a place of charity, and that feeds into the idea of the refugee as perpetually grateful, mm-hmm. and they have to come here, and we'll write, if they become a heart surgeon, we'll write a story about it, and it'll be very heartwarming. Well, no. It's not from a place of charity. It's a place of restitution. This isn't, and so I think My first, at a very pragmatic policy level, the first thing I would say is that in the wake of one of the worst acts of violence in human history in the middle of the previous century, we came up with certain designations of what basic human rights look like and what the consequences are for violating those rights. And I think the least we can do is say, hey, if the planet turns on you as a result of the fossil fuels we've been burning for the past 100 years, here is a designation of what your basic rights are and what the consequences are if those rights are not given to you. Mm-hmm. That would be my first sort of thought of what to do here.
Okay. There is a microphone right at the front of the stage. We have about 10 minutes left, so it's been sanitized. So if you'd like to come up and ask a question, now is the time. Thank you.
Omar, I don't know if you're willing to speak to an audience that may or may not have read the book I have, but I'm wondering if you're willing to speak to the last chapter. And if not, if I can speak to you after in private.
I wanted to ask about that as well, but...
Thank you very much for your question. Show of hands, who wants me to talk about the last chapter? Doesn't want me to talk about it? Okay. All right.
I don't know. They don't know what they're asking.
Right? Yeah, that's true. That's true. That was an unfair question. I will say this. I will say a couple of things. First is that if you go to the Goodreads page for What Strange Paradise, there's a question up front. You know, you can go and ask questions about the book, and the rest of the reading community can chime in. There's only one question, and it says, you cannot see this question because it contains spoilers. And then there's five answers, and all the answers say you cannot see this answer because it contains spoilers. This book is very, very different, I think, and a very different read depending on how familiar the reader is with the two epigraphs, the two works that are quoted in the epigraphs. The only thing I knew when I started the project was I knew how I was going to open it and I knew how I was going to close it. And this went through 8 drafts. A lot of things changed. At no point did the opening and closing parts change. It's some of the kindest and angriest emails I've gotten about this book have all had to do with how it concludes. With American War, I thought the thing I was doing, that trick I was talking about, was fairly self-evident. And then the book ends up coming out 4 months into the Trump administration, and universally almost, it's read in an entirely different way than what I intended. And that chasm has been great for my royalty statements, not so much for, you know, what I intended it to be. And I thought that wasn't going to be the case with this one. And then the first 4 people to read it had 4 entirely different interpretations of what the hell was happening in this book. And that's when I knew something was about to happen. And since that time, there's been a lot of different interpretations that I never imagined, including by some of the writers who blurbed the book. And so I'd get these blurbs where I would say, you know, this is so generous, thank you. I'm not entirely sure what book you read. You know, like it was a very different take on it. But I will say that there's been a correlation between how it's read and that person's... level of hope. It's a very different read, I think. It's pissed off a lot of people, but a lot of things in my books, I think, after the fact, I'm like, I should have changed that, but not the beginning and end of this book. It had to be this particular way for better or worse.
It's going to spark a lot of book club discussions.
Yeah, my books are great for book clubs because people who don't like them really hate them, and so it spurs like a real, you know, gets people going.
Any further questions?
There you are. Yeah, hi. Omar, I'm also a journalist, and so I deeply share your frustration in you know, the difficulty or the feeling that, like, what we do just has no impact, that it's just so ephemeral, right? We're trying to do some good in the world, raise awareness about this, that, or the other. And I'm really curious about whether you feel that writing fiction has more of an impact or has less or is, you know, affects the world in a different way, but sort of how, I guess, whether and to what extent it impacts the real world differently from your journalistic work.
Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. I think the tales are very different. So with journalism, and of course you know this, you write the story the following day, you get the spike in readership, and you can almost sort of see it. They have metrics at all newspapers now for this sort of stuff, and then 2 days later, you know, as the saying goes, they're wrapping fish with it. With fiction, it feels like the exact opposite. You never get that, really. I mean, most books sell most of their copies in the first week, but it's not that kind of spike. What it is that it just lives for a really long time. And I think particularly with fiction is, you know, it's not, at least in my experience, it's not always evident what the hell it is you're learning from this and how it's changing you. You know, I picked up, what was it called, Midnight in Chernobyl, the new book about
Adam Higginbotham, I think.
And I know exactly what I'm learning from that book. I know that in the instant afterwards, it was as hot in there as the surface of the sun, and I can use that in cocktail parties, and it'll make me sound smart, and that's fantastic, but it took me years before I realized that Song of Solomon was teaching me about the power of names and what it means to be given a name versus to give yourself a name and the agency involved in that. And it's a much more abstract thing, and it takes a longer time to kind of, for you to marinate in the thing the book is giving you. And so to me, I think that is the reason I keep returning to this place, is that even though in the short term I have no faith at all that it's going to inspire some policymaker to put forth a bill and so on and so forth, journalism does that very well, because they're afraid of getting asked a question period about it, and so you get that little spike, and you know. And there's an entire, I don't mean this to be flippant, there's an entire award, the Michener, which is primarily based on the merit is how much change did this article or series of articles cause.
How much good did it make for the public?
Yeah. Right, and it's probably the most prestigious journalism award in Canada. I don't think of fiction in that way. I think of fiction as a much more slow-burning thing. And if many years later somebody has changed their outlook on the world very gradually as a result, then my work here is done, and I'm happy with it.
I think we might have had one more question.
I didn't quite make it.
No, that's okay.
Firstly, I want to say thank you for writing this, because I have a lot of immigrant and refugee families at my school, and they're so thankful to be, as you say, in a place where they can just live and do their daily lives safely, and schools are a microcosm of society, and so I really appreciate that statement you made about a simple, just living safely somewhere. And the second point is, kids are impressionable. Kids are the hope and the future of change, and they're very open to perspective and more than we think. So I'm curious to see whether you've thought about children as an audience for you in writing children's books. Because I know they're hard to write to get a message across, but they're impressionable. They're very open. So
thank you for that. I only very, very recently, my daughter is 4 and a half now. Again, she couldn't care less about what daddy does for a living. It doesn't matter at all. Daddy's primary role right now is to be a dinosaur. She's watching Rescue Riders, and so I've seen every one of those episodes like 20 times. I can't stand it. It's an awful show. I don't recommend it. But I was thinking about, you know, again, this idea of, you know, my dad died young. His dad died fairly young. And where she is in her life when I stop being there, relative to what it is I do for a living, which is just plant flags in certain moments in time. Each one of these books is going to sit there on a library shelf collecting dust long after I'm gone. And so I was thinking about, there's a construction you can make of me as a writer based on the books I've written and the short stories and so on and so forth. But that's very different of the construction of me as a human being, which includes a little bit of that, but also a little bit of a lot of other things. And so I was thinking about whether I was ever going to plant a flag that is primarily for her. And once I started thinking in those terms, I immediately wanted to write something fun and joyous and like a space adventure and whatever. So I think about that a lot. The downside is that it's so much harder than this. It's so much harder. Kids are honest. You know, most people in this room, if they really hated the book, would at least find a tactful way of telling me. I've done a few school events. That's not the case. That's not what happens. And so, because I've had a little bit of success with the books, I'm always cognizant of that little bit of ego that seeps in and says, like, you know, because I've done X and been okay at it, then suddenly I can do Y and be... I think what'll have to happen is there'll have to be three children's book equivalents of those novels that are sitting on my hard drive before I get to one that I can actually sort of put out in the world. But I have been thinking about it quite a bit because I think that, you know, I write really depressing books, and fine, that's, you know, it does what it does. But I think joy is an incredibly powerful weapon to wield against everything that's wrong in the world. And so I want to be in that place, and I think of that in the context of my kids. So that's my very rambling maybe, I guess. I should have just said that and saved everybody 10 minutes, but maybe.
The book, once again, is What Strange Paradise. You can buy it out in the lobby. Omar, I'm sure, will be happy to sign a copy. Christmas is coming up as well. Thank you very much for the conversation, and thank you, everybody, for coming out this afternoon.
You have been listening to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers' Fest. To hear more events like this one, please visit our website at writersfest.bc.ca.